Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 14, 2019. The International Crisis Group is calling on the international community to salvage South Sudan's revitalized peace deal.
Security and the boundaries provisions, which were the ones supposed to be done before May, are way behind schedule, but in some ways they're just stuck at the moment. They're stalling out. And we say this is just because ultimately the parties never agreed on these provisions. They were basically punted.
And the South Sudan Defense Minister releases an action plan for ending sexual violence.
The leader of the army here, or police force, organized forces, are blamed for an act committed by those under them. Not only there, but it goes to the President of the Republic. President Salva is suffering, being blamed for the action done by individuals.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new crisis group report on South Sudan's peace deal says external actors should urge the leaders to strike new bargains on security and internal boundaries and accept a third-party protection force for the capital. SIN Dengbio reports from Washington. The report's co-authors say the peace deal is not a finished product and may require revision.
South Sudan is scheduled to form a new unity government in May, but it is far behind in reaching key benchmarks, including unifying a national army and finding solutions to internal boundary disputes. Alan Boswell is the report co-author and senior South Sudan researcher at the International Crisis Group.
The security and the boundaries provisions, which were the ones supposed to be done before May, are way behind schedule, but in some ways they're just stuck at the moment. They're stalling out. And we say this is just because ultimately the parties never agreed on these provisions. They were basically punted. And so the mediators need to finish the job, and they need to revisit how they're planning on doing the unified force and the timeline for that, because they're not going to get this $200 million budget they're asking for, and it won't happen by May.
And the Independent Boundaries Commission has yet to be formed, as Boswell points out. The September 2018 peace deal has some similarities with the 2015 peace deal, according to the report. That deal collapsed in July 2016 when fighting broke out in Juba between government forces and forces loyal to former deputy Riek Machar. Aside from failing to find solutions of security and internal boundaries, the crisis group says the latest peace deal also fails to address longer-term questions about how South Sudan would share power and resources. The parties have agreed to train and screen their respective armed forces and unify them into a national army ahead of the formation of the unity government in May. But that critical step has yet to happen, just 2 months before the pre-transitional government is set to expire. On VOA Straight Talk Africa program this week about the peace process in the country, South Sudan Ambassador to the U.S. Philip Jada Natana said he knows there is a lot of concern that key deadlines may not be met.
For those deadlines to be met, I think some processes actually really needed to be speeded up. But generally, I think it's a problem of resources. That's what people have been talking about. But I think the most encouraging thing among all of this is that actually there is a political will to implement the peace process.
Jada says it's up to the parties to lobby international and regional partners like IGAD and the African Union to help speed up the process. Henry Odwar, the SPLM-IO deputy chairman, said in the same program that funding the peace deal is partly to blame for the lag.
We cannot implement the agreement because of lack of resources, and the international community, the region, have made it abundantly clear that they're not going to contribute a dime towards the implementation of the agreement because of past incidents. And so the international community is saying, you South Sudan, you have the resources to fund this agreement. And indeed, South Sudan produces over 120,000 barrels of oil. And we're saying, Salva, the president of South Sudan, you make sure that the government fund this agreement.
Boswell rejects the notion that the stalled peace process has anything to do with a lack of donor funding.
The idea that the process is not moving forward because of a lack of donor funds is just not true. The capacity is there for the parties themselves to do so, and they should do so. And they should also strike more realistic deals that would not be a more realistic process that would not be so expensive. Now, what is needed from the international community is more leadership on the diplomatic side.
Boswell says it's going to take sustained focus from the region to move the process forward. He says there are a number of things that political leaders can do in that regard.
One of our main recommendations is that we think this unified force deploying to Juba, as currently being negotiated between the parties, is far too close to the 2016 scenario and the 2013 scenario where you had a integrated presidential guard, but whose fighters were basically loyal to different political elite. And so we actually call instead for a limited third-party protection force, specifically with a mandate to protect opposition leaders, but so that the unity government can be formed without having a massive deployment of more forces loyal to different elite in the capital, Juba.
Boswell says it's much too dangerous to leave questions over boundaries, the number of states, and security arrangements unanswered. He warns that could open the door to a repeat of the 2016 scenario. The report argues the parties should come to a consensus soon on moving the May deadline. Ayen Dangbior, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan's defense minister, Kwal Manyang Juk, says sexual-related violence committed by what he calls some rogue soldiers have tarnished the image of South Sudan. The South Sudan People's Defense Forces have announced an action plan aimed at giving commanders powers to identify, arrest, and hand over perpetrators of sexual violence to a military court or any other competent courts for trials. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
The Army's action plan launched today addresses accountability, protection of victims, and prevention to help combat sexual violence within the SSPDF ranks. Lieutenant General Gabriel Jokriak is the Chief of Defense Forces. He says the new guidelines will help the Army deal with soldiers who commit sexual assault or other human rights abuses.
SSPDF remains committed in conducting, promote, and through investigation into all allegations of sexual violence carried out by the armed forces and prosecute alleged perpetrators.
RIAC says the Army will carry out investigations into all allegations of sexual violence by soldiers and will prosecute the perpetrators. South Sudanese authorities have acknowledged that serious violations and human rights abuses have been committed by the warring parties against women and girls during the country's conflict. South Sudan Defense Minister Kwal Manyang Juk says the violations have tarnished the image of his country, which has led to punitive measures.
What else could they do? The most effective one is to sanction us. And when the army is sanctioned, the country is sanctioned, we cannot even get loan. Because they said they are going to use this money for killing their own people, for carrying out violence against women, and so on. We cannot even buy the weapons we need for our units, whether it is army, police, and so on. And so we cannot develop, get money to develop our country. We cannot get money alone for building the capacity of our army.
Human rights groups say survivors of sexual assault often fear reporting the incident to authorities because of the social-cultural stigma attached to such crimes. Juk says military and police commanders must act quickly and arrest the perpetrators of sexual violence.
The leader of the army here, or police force, organized forces, are blamed for an act committed by those under them. Not only there, but it goes to the President of the Republic. President Salva is suffering, being blamed for the action done by individuals who may be under your command, in the area of your command responsibility.
The defense minister says the SSPDF officers must educate their command units on the new guidelines and hold individual soldiers accountable in order to deter others from committing similar crimes. A senior UN official says the army needs to do more than just develop guidelines. Alain Nadohu, the UN Deputy Special Representative to the Secretary General, says military leaders must take prompt action towards ending sexual violence.
Sexual violence is not a matter of sexual issues. It's actually a matter of power. And then we can talk about the action plan. We can talk about the what we need to do. And the work that has been done is fairly respected in terms of the time that people put into it, and we really appreciate the commitment. It's all come down to behavior. If you manage, as leaders, to really commit to what you have put into this work plan, and then we project to the people who are rank and file in the military and elsewhere that we as a leader, we don't condone this. We speak against this. Then that will actually go a very long way, because a behavior change has a much bigger impact than if we just only want to have a system of rules and law. We need to combine them.
Now, Dehu says South Sudanese women and girls are still being sexually abused. He says the UN is committed to supporting efforts to end human rights abuses across South Sudan. In October 2014, President Salva Kiir and the United Nations signed a joint communique aimed at addressing conflict-related sexual violence by taking concrete steps in developing action plans to help soldiers and police officers prevent and respond to sexual violence. The action plan announced today at military headquarters in Juba instructs commanders to undergo mandatory training on prevention and response procedures on cases of sexual violence, and then train soldiers under their command on the same procedures. The guidelines prohibit the deployment or promotion of soldiers who have not taken any training on prevention and response to sexual-related violence. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The U.S. Department of State issued a 1,000-page report yesterday on the human rights practices of countries around the world. Around the world in 2018, including rights abuses in South Sudan. It noted the 2015 peace deal generally held from 2015 until 2016, when fighting broke out in Juba and eventually spread to the rest of the country. It describes how the revitalized peace deal signed in September was still holding at the year's end. But human rights abuses by government forces continued, including ethnically based targeted killings of civilians, forced disappearances, and the mass displacement of some 4.4 million civilians. The report also said the government illegally recruited about 19,000 child soldiers and engaged in torture and widespread rape of civilians. While noting one successful prosecution, it says impunity remains widespread. The report devoted one sentence in its executive summary on South Sudan to note that opposition forces also perpetrated serious human rights abuses, including unlawful killings, abductions, rape and sexual slavery, and forced recruitment. We turn now to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, where the United Nations investigators say intercommunal attacks that killed more than 500 people were orchestrated. The investigators from the UN Human Rights Office in Congo say the attacks may amount to crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein has this report for VOA from Geneva.
The clashes between the Banunu and Batende communities took place in Yumbi territory in Mai Ndombe province between December 16th and 18th. UN investigators who went there found the violence was planned and carried out with the support of traditional chiefs. UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shandasani says the investigators verified at least 535 people were killed and more than 100 others injured.
These figures are most likely an underestimate. The number of casualties is believed to be much higher, as the bodies of some who died are believed to have been thrown into the Congo River. It's also not possible to confirm the number of people who are still missing, as an estimated 19,000 people were displaced by the violence, 16,000 of whom crossed over into the Republic of Congo.
Shamdasani says fights between the two communities over land and fishing resources have broken out in the past, but never on this scale. She says the violence was triggered by a dispute over the burial of a Banunu chief. She says the similarity of the attacks carried out over a three-day period across four different villages indicates prior consultation and organization.
Certain chiefs of the Batende majority villages were cited by many sources as having taken part in the planning of the attacks. The investigation concluded that the crimes documented in Yumbi may amount to crimes against humanity of murder, torture, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, as well as persecution.
The report warns violence is likely to flare up again if the tensions and resentment between the two communities are allowed to fester. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is calling for the perpetrators of the crimes to be punished. She is also urging the government to establish a truth and reconciliation process to address the problems between the Banunu and Batende communities and prevent further violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how are South Sudanese reacting to the Ethiopian airline crash? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you optimistic about Africa becoming more prosperous in the future? Why or why not?
Why not? We will. We've seen a lot of changes, as in modernity, technologies around, everything is changing. Of course we will.
As an African, we are very much confident and we develop ourselves. We can become very prosperous because lots of the resources here are not fully developed yet, like natural resources. So if you're able to focus and develop those things, then we can also go to the top.
I'm optimistic about the prosperity of Africa because I'm an African. So if Africa is not prosperous, in other ways, I'm the one who suffers. I would wish to live in Africa where things are good, employment.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Following the lead of more than 30 countries, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration ordered the immediate grounding of the entire MAX series of Boeing 737 jetliners yesterday. VOA's White House bureau chief Steve Harmon has more from Washington.
The action to halt all flights of the Boeing MAX planes in American airspace is a quick and sudden reversal of the stance taken by the manufacturer, the U.S. airlines flying them, and the administration of President Donald Trump, who had contended there was no reason to order a grounding despite fatal nosedive crashes of two of the planes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Trump says he ultimately decided issuing an emergency order was the right thing to do.
The United States has the greatest record in the world of aviation, and we want to keep it that way. So I didn't want to take any chances.
Until Sunday's crash in Ethiopia, there were nearly 400 of the planes in operation worldwide. Now, all are believed to have been ordered grounded or forbidden from flying in most international airspace. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
A South Sudan aviation official says despite Sunday's deadly crash, Juba has no plans to stop Ethiopian Airlines from flying in and out of the country. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
China, Indonesia, Singapore, Australia, Ethiopia, and now the U.S. have grounded all Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft, while a number of airlines are carrying out additional safety measures in wake of the deadly crash near Addis Ababa. Kur Kwal, general manager of Juba International Airport, says Juba remains committed to welcoming Ethiopian Airlines flying its planes in and out of Juba International Airport. He says the Boeing 737 MAX 8 has never touched down in South Sudan.
This type of the aircrafts never land in Juba here. They've been flying to other, either Europe and other countries in Africa. We have our planes who are coming to Juba here. And we don't have any plan that to prevent all the Ethiopian planes that were flying to South Sudan not to come to South Sudan.
Qual says Ethiopian Airlines typically flies smaller planes like Boeing 737-400s and Boeing 737Q400s into and out of Juba International Airport. While acknowledging Sunday's crash was a tragedy, he says it shouldn't scare away passengers in South Sudan from traveling by air.
It can just happen once in a while. So doesn't mean if there is such a thing happen in another country and like that, you will get scared that such a thing will happen, because it is something that can happen. We don't know whether just a technical, if it is something done by sabotage or what, we don't know this. But the precautions already we were having in Juba and South Sudan here, we are still maintaining.
Qual says the Directorate of Civil Aviation is working to improve the aviation security to avoid unauthorized people gaining access to aircrafts at Juba International Airport.
We have our equipment where we're searching everywhere thoroughly, the baggages and even the hand luggage baggages and body search is there. And also the same when the plane landed, there is a staff of the company who are taking care. There are no someone who is not a stranger that can go to the plane and near the plane and go without anything that is doing there.
Matilda Viola, a passenger traveling to Uganda on Ethiopian Airlines Flight 356, says she is desperate to know what caused Sunday's crash. She says she usually travels by air and won't let the crash discourage her from using planes.
I'm not scared of using air transport after the Ethiopian air crash, because still they are much better and it's not always guaranteed that an accident will happen. And besides, it's not like every other Ethiopian airlines is having the model that crashed. I'm sure they have other airlines that are not the same model like the one that crashed, because that very model is the one that crashed in Indonesia last year. I'm not expecting it in South Sudan.
Viola believes the MAX 8 aircraft has never landed in South Sudan, but she says if she were in another country and booked on a MAX 8, she will request to be changed. Qual says airport personnel will continue to be vigilant at Juba International Airport as investigators probe the cause of Sunday's crash. One Sudanese was among the 157 people who died in the accident. No South Sudanese were on board Flight 302. For VOA News, I am Wene Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Kenya, where a severe drought in East Africa, now in its seventh year, threatens widespread famine. Experts cite several causes for the lack of rain, including climate change and increasingly harsh El Nino fluctuations. For more on what the drought means to East African farmers and those who depend on them, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to New York University Environmental Studies Professor Sanali Mahmid.
It could mean many things. One, if you're taking away production from the region, that's going to be a deficit in your income as a household and even regionally, which means that you're going to have less money to buy supplies for your crops if you're going to be planting anything else. Or it might mean that you don't have enough money to go and purchase food at the local markets, or perhaps you don't have enough money for healthcare, or you don't have enough money to send your kids to school. The longer the drought happens, the more all of these other household obligations become difficult.
And what are some solutions to these challenges in the short and middle term?
Some of that can be solved with good and very mindful aid, so bringing in food supplies to the region. But one of the fears that we have is that that food might not get distributed to everybody who needs it at the time that they need it. And so we also need to think about how to make farmers a bit more resilient in the face of what might be ongoing droughts into the future.
What are some ways that farmer resilience can be promoted, given the near certainty that the number of extreme droughts is likely to grow as climate change worsens?
So some of these solutions rely on expanding farmers' access to financial tools and markets outside of agriculture. Some really important things moving into the future are going to be the planting of drought-tolerant varieties or heat-tolerant varieties of crops that don't require as much water to grow. So I think an important part of this is going to be enabling local researchers and organizations to improve and develop varieties of crops. This could mean pulses or sorghum or coarse grains. So seed development is going to be one part of this. Providing water for irrigation, that's not possible everywhere, but trying to see if irrigation systems can be expanded in these regions is also going to be part of the solution as well, too.
And of course, land management is a big part of it, too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Making sure that your soils and your whole agroecosystem can hold on to both the nutrients and water as much as possible. And that might mean growing a diversity of crops, and a lot of these farmers do already, but making sure that that's very deliberate and making sure that you're building soil health is also going to be really important for these regions moving forward.
Are you reasonably optimistic that these resiliency strategies will be put in place, or are we just looking at more extreme droughts and starvation in East Africa?
I think we're better equipped now than we were, say, back in the 80s and 70s. I'm not going to deny at all that climate change and the increasing level of climate change is going to really make this challenging. But there's a lot more brain power working on this problem as well, both from within the African continent and outside. We also know now that farmers derive a lot of their household security from off-farm activities. This could mean their kids going into local cities and sending money back, or they're doing off-farm labor. These are also opportunities to make sure that even in times where they're not yielding properly due to drought, it's important that the government steps in, or that there's other safety nets, both either market-driven or government-driven, that farmers can access. It's not just going to be the seed that saves a farmer from drought. It's not just going to be irrigation. It's not just going to be remittances from the city. It's going to be a combination of all of those things together that make these communities more resilient. And that means that all the experts, your economists, your social scientists, your crop scientists, your climate scientists, the farmers groups, all of these people need to come together to make sure that these solutions are in place, because this is a multi-factor problem. It's not just the climate that causes this. And I think now that we're recognizing that, we're going to be much better equipped to tackle it, even in a changing climate.
That was Environmental Studies Professor Sonali McDermid of New York University speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. From New York, we will take you down to Wau with the song Sokpa by Gonda Golo.
Baba Ungolo Kaizenove Neruguda Tasoba Rugude Bindo Muso Kugu Zoiso
We have been listening to Gonda Golo with the song Soba. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Data sikinzo mina yowe
Soba tibunditi kaba Data sopa ntizi
Mereko na bandong la Unoka kanti mano yowe
Mbusa uido
Wanande.